Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Pedro Gustavo Teixeira, author of The Legal History of the European Banking Union, released this year by Hart Publishing. Since the political and economic integration of Europe got underway in 1950, this has tended to accelerate through functional mini-unions, coal and steel, nuclear power, and maybe next, healthcare. The latest of these projects is the banking union, born out of necessity at the height of the European financial crisis, but as Dr. Teixeira points out in this new history, built on foundations laid in the 1970s. The new union was given its political go-ahead in 2012, and by 2015, its core agencies, the single supervisory mechanism under the authority of the European Central Bank, and the single resolution mechanism were in place. Enormous changes have taken place since that summit 9 years ago, but the union still has critical unfinished business. Few people are better qualified to guide us through this history from the inside than Dr. Teixeira. He joined the ECB at its creation more than 20 years ago, working on questions of financial stability, became an advisor to the vice president, then ran the general secretariat before becoming the director general of banking supervision last October. Pedro, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Tim. Thanks for organizing this. It's a pleasure to talk about my book, and you already did a very nice summary. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Well, one thing I missed out from your CV is that you also teach at the Goethe University Institute for Law and Finance, and I believe this book is partly based on your course notes and you know the lectures that you teach. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, it's fascinating to be able to link between, my professional learning and then being able to pass it on to students. And one of the challenges was that actually every year I had to revise completely the course because there have been so many things, so many novelties going on. And so that forced me to indeed invest, every time, every year into the academic literature and reflect about what was going on. And I was particularly challenged by the students. And as you can imagine, particularly during the height of the sovereign debt crisis, I had many students from Greece, from my country, Portugal, and others, and they were very critical. And that made me think a lot about what I was doing as well at the bank.
Yeah. How long have you been teaching that course?
I think it must have started in 2001. A little bit. So once the euro was introduced, there were many changes taking place at financial regulation. And the University of Frankfurt decided to create this sort of master's course that makes a link between the practitioners and the academic world.
And who or what gave you the idea of turning this into a book?
This then became also at some point a dissertation for my PhD, but it was also very much sort of, as I tried to mention in the beginning, a sort of a professional autobiography. So it's very much what I learned without inside knowledge as much as possible. but very much about my reflections and in my technical work here at ECB. And it was very much the trying to find a logic for all these developments that have been quite fast. I mean, when I started 20 years ago, although it's some time now, I could not imagine that we will go very far. And one of the starting points was when I started working, I was privileged to work with Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa. Mm-hmm. This was also very much at the origin of the monetary union. And his main point, and this I had the privilege to help him to make that point, was that a monetary union without a banking union had a structural flaw. And so it was, at the time, we would think, okay, one day maybe the banking union will be established, maybe banking supervision will be transferred to ECB because the central bank is well positioned. But I honestly never expected this would happen in my career. So the way it happened so quickly as well made me reflect, and this book is the result of those reflections.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to some of the shortcomings of the banking union later, but did you feel that some of its achievements and the speed at which it had been put together were perhaps underappreciated, and that was another reason for getting this book out?
It's difficult to... I mean, clearly, the banking union is a result of a perfect storm. So, as I argue in the book, is a combination of structural factors that have been going on. I trace it back to the SPAC report in 1956, to then, as you mentioned, in the 70s, the 80s with the start of the single market, then the introduction of the euro, and then the combination of the great financial crisis that started actually in 2007 and peaked at the end of 2008. And then followed immediately by the sovereign debt crisis. So this has been, now we have the pandemic, but there's been years of many crises put together. And my argument is that this was not only the crisis, but actually there was some structure, the logic that was instilled in the Treaty of Rome. And so in that sense, you're right that there's been a little bit underappreciated how quickly and it was set up and how remarkable it is, and this is what I tried to show in the book. At the same time, it was not inevitable, but maybe there was an element of likelihood that indeed it was. It is a little bit in the DNA of European integration that in order to preserve integration, you have to integrate more. And this has been very much at the heart of the debate about the existence of the European Union.
Yeah. And before the formation of the banking union from 2013 onwards, you run through in the book, you run through these four previous stages, the integration through harmonization from the mid 70s to the mid 80s, through competition to the late 90s, through governance until the eve of the financial crisis in 2007. And then integration, or as you say, potential disintegration through crisis from 2008 to 12. Can we quickly run through, well, not too quickly, but run through the different periods? So starting with the first stage, 1973 to 84, which you sort of characterized by, as you said earlier, the kickoff from Paul Henry Spaak, and the underpinning sort of ordo-liberal thinking, the idea that the law around financial markets should be very constrained and run by independent agencies. Can we go back to that first stage?
Sure. What I argue and what I researched also from looking, at interviews that were made to the main protagonists at the time, was that the main objective from the beginning has been to create a common market. So it was felt, and particularly by Spaak, and not so much by Jean Monnet, but Spaak felt that, the way to make progress was not to go through trying to have a political community from the start. And this was due to the failure in the early 50s of the European defense community, but instead to argue we should go towards a common market, to have a free market, and the objective of the treaty and then of European law should be to realize economic freedoms. And then by having a market and an integrated market, then the rest will follow. So that was even more than the Monnet method, was very much the Spark method, and it had many influences. It had the influences of the antitrust law from the US at the time that influenced a lot of formation of the European community, but also indeed of the ordo-liberal thinking at the time. And this was, it matched also the sort of German thinking of the, particularly of the finance ministry at the time. But it was a combination of things. I mean, I hesitate a little bit in the book to call it, you know, a purely ordo-liberal thinking, because in reality, it came from many different influences. And so the what I try to look is how this sort of thinking, so realizing the common market via enforcing the economic freedoms, what were the approaches to get there? And so what you see is as influence of the context of the time, the economic situation, the ideology also of the time, that there were several approaches, but there was always a common denominator to those approaches, which was to realize economic freedoms via European law, but without transferring the competences to the European level. So without political competences at European level. So the idea was to have a common market that was exclusively regulated by European law and without interference of the member states. So this was attempted initially in the 70s by having what I call integration via harmonization. So the idea was that you would harmonize all the national laws until you get common rules, because it would be all the same. So then you'd have the common market. This has failed because there was unanimity voting, and so clearly it was impossible to harmonize everything, and particularly very quickly. And so there was no, in my view, no financial integration until the 80s, when Jacques Delors and the Commission at the time presented a white paper on integrating the single market, and there it was influenced by also the Margaret Thatcher influenced a lot.
Quite ironic how you point that out.
So, so that was a big push towards integration, was the single market concept. But even there, I mean, and there the concept was, let's realize economic freedoms by letting, you know, the market create its own rules. So let's have regulatory competition, let's have everybody competing. And we do this via the, now also in the context of Brexit, people talk about the single passport. And so the single passport means that one member state recognizes the other's laws and jurisdiction over the companies of origin, in this case, the financial companies of origin. And so also a lot has been talked about it, but in reality, this was also not very successful because, I mean, the member states remained protectionist. They applied several exceptions. And so in reality, they did not allow the law of another member state to apply in their own jurisdiction. So this I call integration through competition. And again, I think challenging a bit the myth, in reality, there was not much integration.
Yeah, you make a couple of really good points there. What one is, as you say, there was this general good exception that was, as you say, represented a powerful obstacle. But you also point out that, you know, while the preference of European policymakers was that you get cross-border provision of financial services, in fact, because of these host country obstacles, the preferred mode of market entry was acquisition of local firms. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it does sort of challenge the myth about the efficacy of the passport, I think.
A lot. So in practice, I mean, not a lot of integration has happened until then, until the euro was introduced. But indeed, the myth was that we had a single market in financial services and it was well integrated. And that was not the case, I would say, in all fields, insurance, securities and banking. So I think that the difference came with the monetary union, that with the euro, as we know, the transparency of prices, the fact that there was no exchange rate risk, and also a big push that, I mean, the euro showed and was a powerful symbol as well, that there was an integrated market. And so all the incentives were made for, let's create pan-European institutions, let's expand, let's have, you know, even small countries can have, you know, large institutions and being able to provide their services across the single market. And so the paradigm then was very strong, that it didn't matter where a bank would come from. It could be a very small member state. And at the limit, we even had Iceland that was using the single passport. they can expand without limits within the single market. And so that was the paradigm, and it lasted. And so there was a strong integration then from 98 until the financial crisis. And the financial crisis revealed what was wrong about this construction. And the construction was, let's create a free market, let's enforce economic freedoms. But since we don't want to transfer competences to the European Union, then there won't be any stabilization capacity. So as I put it right at the end of the book, the whole concept was everybody can benefit from the single market. So it's a community of benefits, but we don't want to share the risks. So it's just a win-win situation for all. And if something goes wrong, then we see what happens. And what happened in 2008, and then it continued, was disintegration. Because, I mean, the flaw in all this construction was that in the end, you cannot really have a single market without some sort of stabilization capacity at European level. So it's a total contradiction. And what the process led to was, in the end, that there were no competences at European level or national level that were able to cope with the risks of an integrated market. So that's a bit of a contradiction that I try to explore and explain how this logic of a single market just with rules and no institutions, how this can have the seeds for its own disintegration. And then when this happens, you have this binary choice, which is a bit what is always discussed about European Union, is either you integrate more or you disintegrate. There doesn't seem to be nothing in between. So it's always about extremes. And this is very much due to the fact that the EU delivers in terms of output legitimacy. So the main legitimacy is the results, the positive results it has. And whenever something does not deliver such positive results, immediately it is criticized. And so that's a bit the flaw. Mm. And this is what I argue that needs to be overcome in the future.
Yes, you make this point. I mean, in the final the chapter on the 2013 period onwards, that the idea really was that the SSM banks, or the banks that are basically are subject to supervision by the SSM, had essentially lost their nationality. And you say, quote, the aim was to enable a bank failure to be as close as possible to any other commercial company. Would you say that the experience since then has, fulfills that wish? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of Monte dei Paschi, the Venetian banks, that really the governments are very resistant to allowing the hierarchy of losses under the Bank Recovery and Resolution Directive to take place. Is the spirit of the banking union being kept as much as the law?
I think there it relates a little bit to your first also point that it has been very fast. You know? So the all this change of regime, a total regime change, and in particular, as I argue, in the field of bank resolution, was a sort of transition from having the state and the taxpayers being responsible for bailing out a bank. And this changed from almost one day to the other to a sort of a private risk sharing regime, meaning that it's even forbidden for the taxpayers to rescue a bank. Mm-hmm. And so this was due to the experience of 2008 and 2009. But it was also due to the experience of the sovereign debt crisis, and in particular is due to the logic that you cannot have risk sharing at European level. So there is no mechanism that you could have at European level to rescue now banks with European taxpayers' money. And so what I feel is the transition was very fast, and clearly these transition of regimes are complex and complicated, and this is why you see that it's not sometimes very smooth, that transition. But I assign it more to that than to the compliance with the law or not. So it's a total regime change to the extent that even banks in the past, it was argued that the rating of the bank depended on the rating of the member state where they were coming from. Yeah. So this is what created then the vicious circle that led to the creation of the banking union. So the nexus between the soundness of the member states and the soundness of the banks. So to change that, so it's removing a subsidy to some extent, so public subsidy to banks. This is the takes time, taking into account that the banking sector has been crucially important for economic growth in Europe and member states. And again, this is why we have a banking union in the end.
I mean, perhaps it's unfair of me to suggest that the banks stand out as this special case, given that governments are reluctant to let any companies, go out of business. If you look at, for example, the airlines, they don't seem to be treated particularly any differently from the banks. I want to go back to, we'll certainly come back to what's going to happen next and some of the unfinished business, but I'd like to go back to some of the history as well. I was quite surprised reading your book at how, because I always expect the European Union to move by crisis, to make big changes when they have no choice but to make new changes. But there are quite a few occasions where, for example, in the 1998 to 2007 period, big discretionary changes were made. Like, for example, you say community law provided for the first time extraterritorial powers to national authorities. There was this discussion, for example, about having absolute home state authority. I mean, it didn't happen, but the fact that that discussion was taking place. Do you think has there been more discretionary push towards integration than perhaps people give policymakers credit for?
My argument in the book is that it relates very much to the logic of European law. No, so the logic was you need to realize economic freedoms, and you have this historic evolution where, in a way, everything was tried. No, so the top-down approach was tried in the 70s. Then the bottom-up approach was tried in the 80s via this having regulatory competition. Then something in the middle, a third way was attempted with what I call the new governance. So the so-called multi-level governance, which was to have committees of national authorities to come up with European interests. Mm. Then this as well had many, many flaws. And then, as you say, then the other possibilities was to extend the jurisdiction of one member state over the other and to have a sort of extraterritorial. So what there was an attempt to have all the approaches in order to have common rules. So the quest in the past 50 years has been how to have common rules. And this quest, this is the argument of my book, ends with the banking union, where there's a full centralization of competences. And so the point is that this supranational path that many have argued that is integration by stealth, and that in reality all this was done, hidden from the public. What I argue is that this was always clear from the SPAC report that gave origin to the Treaty of Rome. Mm-hmm. This has been always the path. And so what the institutions, European institutions, and the design of the law that was approved by the Council and European Parliament was always towards creating ways, and sometimes creative ways, of developing these common rules and enforcing these common rules. So this is what I try to argue, that there is a logic that, regardless of all these different approaches, that gives the impression that actually there was a lot going on, but the thread is the same one across all these years, all these decades.
Mm-hmm. You also make a point during that that same period, 98 to 2007, that one of the reasons that monetary union went ahead without banking union was Bundesbank's worry about the moral hazard of combining supervision with monetary policy. And then in the banking union chapter, you talk about essentially how that was managed, the creation of the supervision board and so on. From your experience inside the ECB, how has that gone in practical terms, that separation between the monetary policy function and the supervisory function?
I think at the time of the creation of the Monetary Union, so the debate was indeed whether to have the ECB, also with banking supervision powers. And actually, this was also pushed, I believe, a lot by the Bank of England, because that was the model, so that the central banks had supervision when the Maastricht Treaty was being prepared in the early 90s. And the concern, and again, very much linked to this concept that at European level, you can only have rules and not institutions and no transfer of competences. The decision at the time to be consistent was, well, we cannot transfer as well regulatory policies to the ECB, because this would imply that the monetary union then would imply some sort of distribution or redistributional objectives, because in the end, financial regulation and banking regulation implies also a level of distribution and also of making choices. So the design of the monetary union, as I think now everybody knows, is very much around ECB pursuing a clear objective, price stability, and so it's a rule-based framework. Mm-hmm. And so banking supervision, I think, was seen as not really fitting into that concept, even though it would make sense, but clearly would not fit into that concept. So that debate emerged again once the SSM and banking supervision was being transferred to the ECB, and in the debates that took place in 2012 and 2013, and it was exactly the same debate. So how can we avoid, if you wish, polluting the pursuance of price stability by the ECB with also the banking supervision? Because at the limit, there could be a conflict of interest whereby the central bank would be trying to rescue banks via monetary policy. And so this is what I try to explain in the book, that this debate shapes to a large extent the way banking supervision has been organized. And so in reality, we have and that I explore a lot in the book, the so-called principle of separation, in the sense that within the ECB, they are almost as if it were two different institutions, the one institution dealing with central banking matters and the other one dealing with banking supervision. So there is a link that the Governing Council is the main decision-making for both banking supervision and monetary policy. But this link is mitigated by the fact that we have a procedure called non-objection, according to which the Governing Council can only object to proposals for supervisory decisions taken by the supervisory board. So it's a somewhat convoluted decision-making, but it fulfills the objective of having this separation, this strict separation between the monetary policy mandate and the banking supervision mandate. And even though, I mean, indeed, I'm an insider, but I think by all evidence that has been accumulated in the past 6 years, 7 years, it works. I mean, there's clearly a very strong separation. This has not been questioned, and decision-making has been quite fluid. But this, again, I would say that in any case, but clearly that's the evidence I gathered so far.
What do you do on the occasions where there is potentially clear overlap? For example, if the ECB wants to, if the monetary policy side wants to do something like the TLTROs, you know, something which has a substantial impact on the banks or the dividend ban, or there are any number of these things that are crossovers between monetary policy and bank. How do you tend to manage those things without giving too much away?
I think the honest answer is that there is really the rules that we have set up, they are followed in the sense that the decisions are taken autonomously. So the central banking side takes those decisions without considering the banking supervision aspects. And vice versa. So it's clearly, I mean, this is why some would even argue that the benefits of combining supervision in the central bank are not fully exploited, because in many central banks, and particularly in the past, all these aspects were combined. So this is the debate that has been going on for many decades. But in reality, what happens is those rules are strictly followed. This is what I observe.
So we've discussed your five chapters. You, at the end of the book, you talk about what your potentially next chapter would be, which is a chapter of integration through politics. And you've already said that one of the key missing elements is this full risk sharing, but the other is democratic legitimacy. What do you see as the democratic legitimacy policy? Sorry, problem, not policy.
The problem and the flaw, and this again also goes very much to the debate in the 50s and the debate between Jean Monnet and Paul-Henri Spaak about the concept of the common market, in the sense that Monet wanted to go towards a more narrow approach, but deeper, so to have a sort of a political community from the start, while Spaak, and that was the concept that was then reflected in the Treaty of Rome, wanted a wide market without political integration. And I think now that the banking union shows that this is a flaw, in the sense that if you integrate a market, and the more you integrate it, you need to have a stabilization capacity. It means the capacity to stabilize, you know, market failures, market shocks. And this includes fiscal capacity, so the capacity to use public funds at the limit. Also includes enforcement capacity, so that you are able to enforce the rules throughout the market. And this cannot be done without some sort of competences and, as you mentioned before, some discretionary competences at European level. So the conundrum is, how are you going to be able to have stabilization capacity for an integrated market if you don't transfer that capacity to the European level? And if you do that, then you need to make sure that this is legitimate, so that because that stabilization capacity means that you have to take distributional choices. So you have to decide that, for example, you're going to use fiscal funds in some member state and not the other, for example, at some stage. And then this can be inverted in the future. So these sort of decisions, this is what is missing now in an integrated market. So that's a little bit my concern, that without having that stabilization capacity, there'll be always doubts about the sustainability of the EU. And but if we want that stabilization capacity, then we have to find a way to make sure that this is democratically legitimate, meaning that if a certain decision is taken to use funds, this is not challenged in other corners of the EU, or in some corners of the EU, depending on who gains with the. With the stabilization initiatives, and for example, now in the pandemic, you see that debate also taking place. So it's complicated, but I see it as key for the future sustainability of the union.
I'm trying to understand though exactly what you mean by what is the lack of democratic legitimacy. I mean, for example, I didn't see a big pushback coming from the northern. You saw a pushback coming from some of the northern states' executives. You didn't see really very much pushback from their parliaments on the pandemic relief, for example. Are you suggesting that the Council of Ministers alone, would not have the democratic legitimacy to oversee the stabilization measures, and this is something that would have to be overseen by the European Parliament, or could it be something that is legitimized by the national executives and their national parliaments?
I think that the pandemic was a positive step forward, as I conclude briefly in the book, since it was finalized before the pandemic was still starting. I think the pandemic was clearly a step forward. This is why it has been hailed as indeed a sign that indeed there is a willingness to move forward. But I think what you mentioned, that has been exactly the debate in the establishing the banking union. So whether you're going to have accountability at the European level only, or whether you're going to involve also national parliaments. And so in the regulation that set up the banking union and the so-called single supervisory mechanism, this is one of the innovations, so that the accountability of an European institution like ECB remains towards the European Parliament, but the national parliaments also feature in the reporting. And the reason is, and I think there's even a recital in the regulation that mentions it, is because the impact of the decisions in banking supervision can have not only a European-wide impact, but also impacts on member states more than others. Yeah. And so this is the state of the debate. Are you going to put everything together, so national sources of accountability together with European sources, and so you put everything together, or are we going to develop something new? So where there is indeed no challenge in the future that certain decisions are legitimate. I think that the weakness in all this debate is that it's not very clear what will be the solution. This is what you are hinting at. It's not very clear what would be the framework that would solve these problems. I mean, it's a debate that's going on for a long time. We have reports at the level of the European Union on this. We have many academics discussing it, but I haven't seen yet a sort of a credible design of what would be then this ideal world. So, I mean, I don't think that the European Union is not democratic. There are many sources of democracy, but clearly there is an issue that when decisions are taken at European level that have welfare effects, and this has been resisted throughout all these decades to a large extent, but once you have them, then you have to make sure that these decisions then do not cause upheaval. That's a bit the challenge. But the pandemic, I think so far it has been showing that in a sort of a public health emergency, and in an area where also Europe doesn't have the competences, clearly there is a unity around those decisions. And so that has been clearly a positive step, as many have observed.
Yeah. A couple of immediate outstanding issues for potentially the banking union. One is what will be done with these non-performing loans as we come out of the pandemic crisis. And your colleague, Andrea Enria, has been proposing the creation of a European bad bank or a network of bad banks supported by European funding. Do you think this has a chance of coming into existence?
Would you mind repeating? Because I think I missed your last sentence.
So the idea of a European bad bank or a network of bad banks supported by European finance, do you think this has a chance of coming into existence?
This proposal by my chair is about having a policy coordination. We have been through this before with the great financial crisis. We have also examples coming from what was done in the US and other countries. And so the question is how, again, to coordinate, which is also to some extent a distributional problem. And I think all evidence from the past is that if the NPLs and the resolution of NPLs is well coordinated, and since we have a banking union, should be coordinated at European level, if this is done, we have the best possible outcome. So it comes from historical evidence. And so again, it links very much to the argument in my book that once you have distributional decisions to make in the banking union, these have to be taken at European level. So it's a similar debate regarding the European deposit insurance, where the problem is that it may happen that in real terms, an euro deposited in a country with a weak deposit insurance scheme then is worth less than a euro deposited in a bank of a country with a strong deposit insurance scheme. So we cannot have deposits in euros having different worth, different value across member states. So also there, that's the argument to have a European deposit insurance scheme. And then we have again the arguments of the past about moral hazard and whether we can have these sort of distributional mechanisms at European level. So I think the proposal by Andrea Enria is a consequence, is an implication of having a banking union, the same as a European deposit insurance scheme. They all fall in the same category. And so that shows how still incomplete is this process of transition, as I was mentioning before.
Yeah, and the other big piece of unfinished business, it seems to me, is potentially it's got worse, which is this increase in domestic holdings of home state sovereign bonds. So Yeah, and it's been proposed for many, many years that there should be some kind of prudential limits on this for the domestic banks. And at the same time, you've got all these major banks becoming essentially Europeanized. Do you think the collective action clauses that have been introduced to the bonds and the BRRD itself will provide the necessary signals over time for banks to not to be overexposed to their domestic sovereign? Or is there another potential solution to this?
In the context of my book, I mean, what I mentioned is that all that you are referring to, the collective action clauses and domestic holdings of sovereign bonds, all this relates to this debate regarding risk reduction. You know, that what was mentioned in the beginning of the banking union, and for example, one of the main initiatives that were taken and that before the single supervisory mechanism was established was to have a stress test. It was called the comprehensive assessment. So where all the banks that were supervised and are supervised by the ECB, they were subject to a stress test to assess, you know, their soundness before being supervised at European level, and therefore before being in a way subject to the European control. And so all that you mentioned is clearly is about to debate that the banks have to be Europeanized, not just in terms of the European regime and European protection, if you wish, or European regulation, but also in terms of their balance sheets. So that if they have to be Europeanized, and also their balance sheets have to be Europeanized. And this has been very much in the debate, so-called, of risk reduction. So that, and again, linked to the moral hazard debate, where some member states should not then be more liable for the banks of other member states. So this process, again, is a process that takes time. So the transition takes time, but that's the direction. So the Europeanization of the banking system in all its aspects.
Okay. Well, finally, I ask every guest to recommend a book, any book they like, to listeners. What have you chosen?
I was thinking about it, and maybe somewhat unconsciously also had a little bit of an influence in when I was writing this book, is one from Mark Mazower, the historian, called Dark Continent, about the 20th century in Europe. And I think his main argument is that the Europe's democracy and democratic regimes possibly was one of the outcomes, one of the conceivable outcomes of the tumultuous history of the 20th century. So his main argument is that it was not inevitable that democracy would become the dominant regime in Europe, that this was one of the possible outcomes, and so we should not take it for granted. And so in my book, I'm not sure if I was successful in that, but I tried to also mention that integration was not inevitable. European integration, the banking union was not inevitable. Maybe it was likely due to the logic that has been there since the Treaty of Rome, but clearly we can have many other outcomes. And so this is why we have to, I mean, every day look at what can be improved and what and critically challenge as well the future of the European Union. Yeah. And so this is why the book by Mark Mazower is also quite important in that regard.
Yeah, right. Excellent choice. Today I've been talking to Pedro Gustavo Teixeira about the legal history of the European Banking Union, released this year by Hart Publishing. Pedro, thanks again for coming on.
Thanks a lot. It was really a pleasure.